Welcome to the virtual advising session today for the Fulbright Scholar Awards to South and Central Asia. My name is Michelle Valorci, and I am based in the D.C. office of IIE. I do outreach and recruitment for the South and Central Asia region, so I'm happy to welcome you to this webinar as we approach the application deadline of August 1st. So the purpose of this webinar today is to answer your questions. It really serves as an open-ended session where you can type in your questions into the chat box. And if there's any questions that we don't get to today or you come up with after the webinar, please feel free to email me and I'll follow up with you. Before we begin, I want to underscore that this advising session is for the Fulbright Scholar Program. This is for opportunities to teach and research abroad. To be eligible, you must be a U.S. citizen. And if you are tuning in today and you're interested in the, if you've recently graduated with your bachelor's or master's degree and you're in the middle of pursuing a PhD, we recommend that you check out the Fulbright Student Program. So that is the program that offers recent graduates and students to research and to study abroad. So today's session is for scholar applicants, and let's begin with the advising. So just a brief background on the Fulbright Scholar Program. It was established in 1946, and really, you know, the idea that Senator Fulbright had was to bring people from across cultures together through the common goal of research and education and to create mutual understanding. And so the Fulbright Program was born, and since then, IIE has been administering the program, which is funded by the U.S. Department of State, and specifically within Department of State, the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs works with us closely and the binational Fulbright commissions abroad to administer and have this program operate all around the world. The Fulbright program has evolved tremendously since its inception, and over the past 7 decades, it's really expanded and the opportunities have increased as well as the types of opportunities. You can see in the left-hand picture we have one of our first grantees to Burma, and he was there researching on Burmese dance, and that was in 1960. And on the picture on the right-hand side is one of our newer collaborative research projects called the Arctic Initiative, bringing scholars from across the Arctic region to study important themes that are relevant to that area. So you can really see kind of the scope and the breadth of the program, and really happy to continue to offer opportunities for the 2019-2020 academic year. In terms of what the core program, so I'll be referencing the core program, this is the program to teach and research abroad, and we have actually about 135 countries that we have this program for U.S. scholars. There are also some administrator seminars available, and you can find that information more about that on our website. But in terms of the scholar program, it is open to all disciplines. And, in fact, a lot of the awards in the catalog do say that they are all disciplines awards. So it's very open in that sense. You would apply to a specific award in a specific country. And you may only apply to one award per cycle, so per competition. This year's deadline is August 1st. And with whom you affiliate abroad is actually partly up to you or partly determined in the award description. So there's a variety of hosts that can be your affiliation, and specifically in the South and Central Asia region, that is the case where oftentimes the scholar needs to propose a potential host. If you look at the chart here, the graph, you can see that there's really no one way to do a Fulbright Scholar Award. You know, teaching and research are very popular, but we have a lot of awards that are really interested in just having American scholars come and teach and kind of build capacity and have that one-on-one interaction in the classroom. So there's really no particular preference unless it's outlined in the award, so it's really up to you to determine what you would like to do on your grant. As I mentioned earlier, this is a program for U.S. scholars to teach and research abroad, and so U.S. citizenship is required. In terms of other eligibility requirements, again, it really depends on the award what it's looking for, what it requires. Each award is unique. So we have 473 awards in the catalog, 83 of which are in the South and Central Asia, or 14 of which are in the South and Central Asia. And so it's really important to take a look, does it require a PhD, is it open to professionals outside of academia, and are artists and musicians also welcome? So the Fulbright program is really open to not just academics, but professionals as well. So we'll be discussing a little bit about those kind of options available. And in terms of awards that have a teaching component, oftentimes they will list a teaching years of teaching as a requirement. So some say 3 years, some say 5 years. It really depends. Some might not have any stipulated requirement, but it's really important to take a look at what is the preference and what will, you know, how will you appear as a competitive applicant. In terms of those of you that have held Fulbrights in the past, Fulbright Scholar grants in the past, we have a policy that you must wait 2 years in between the time that you complete your grant to the time that you apply for one. So if you completed a grant in, for example, September of 2016, you would not be eligible to apply by the August 1st, 2018 deadline. You would need to wait until the August 1st, 2019 deadline. If you've held a Fulbright student grant, even though if it was a research grant, that's not a problem. You're eligible to apply. The student program is separate from the scholar program. All right, so part of the process in determining which award is right for you is also determining, you know, what the award is looking for, what Fulbright is right for you. We do have the flex option available in 4 countries in the region. This allows you to make multiple visits over the course of 2 academic years. And I should also note that the flex option is strictly available for research projects. So if your anticipated project involves teaching, a percentage of teaching, the flex option would not be available to you. And then, of course, there are several awards that are open to postdocs or early career applicants. And then we do have a Distinguished Chair Award in the region based in India. And we also have one multi-country award, so I'll be kind of highlighting that. The Global Scholar Award is one that is unique. It allows you to select 2 to 3 countries within, in 2 or 3 world regions. So if you wanted to do something with, for example, India and South Africa, that would be something that would sit in the Global Scholar Award. And in terms of the awards to South and Central Asia, a lot of them do not require a home affiliation, or even a letter of invitation from a host. So we do welcome applications from professionals and independent scholars, emeriti, faculty. All of those profiles are welcome to apply. Okay, so let us hit on the South and Central Asia Awards. Let's go straight to that. In terms of, I just want to give you a little overview before we take questions and kind of go into the nitty-gritties. The South and Central Asia region covers the South Asian countries of Pakistan, India, Nepal, Bangladesh, Bhutan, and Maldives in Sri Lanka. Now, for this year, the program to Bangladesh is not available, but the other countries I mentioned are open and running. And then the Central Asian countries of Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan. So these are the countries that this webinar is focused on. If you are interested in any of the East Asia and Pacific region, the countries there such as China, Singapore, Thailand, etc., we did hold a webinar yesterday on the East Asia Pacific region. So that'll be archived within 5 days. So you can tune into that or reach out to my colleague Alexa Rowland, who is in charge of the East Asia-Pacific region. But specifically, the South and Central Asia region covers those 11 countries that I just mentioned. And we have 14 awards in those 11 countries. And among those 14 awards, there are 83 grants available. That means up to 83 scholars can go to South and Central Asia. So, for example, one award may have 5 grants. So that's one thing to keep in mind. We also offer the Fulbright Regional Travel Program. So for any grantees who are selected to South and Central Asia, once you're in country, you're eligible to apply for the Regional Travel Grant, which allows you to travel outside of your country but within the region. So let's say if you're based in Kazakhstan and you'd like to give a lecture or host a workshop in Uzbekistan, you'd be able to do that. Or if you're based in India and you'd like to do something in Sri Lanka, you would apply for that and get the funding for that and you know, give some details about what you hope to do. So that grant is up to 2 weeks, and it allows you to have more exposure as a Fulbright scholar in the region. I also want to point out we have a regional web page, and you'll see the icon that's in the center. That is the one you'll be looking for, and I'll be showing that to you. In fact, we can click on that as well. The regional web page is a great resource, and it gives you the overview and a wonderful chance to see what other scholars have done in the past, and you can click on our story map and see different things that scholars and what their projects were, et cetera. So this is great. And then any of the featured awards as well as the resources and contacts. So that would be you know, the webinars and all that kind of thing. So this is a great page. And then we also have the blog post that is new. And this will be updated very soon with more information that I hope that you can tune into. So this is in the works. So just want to give you some of the resources on our website and point you in the right direction. So in addition to that, all scholars who are selected to the South and Central Asia region will also be able to participate in the Fulbright mid-year conference that takes place in India, usually in the months of February or March. And India is one of the, it's the largest commission in the region, the largest Fulbright commission in the region. And so they're very supportive and very active across the region in supporting and having our scholars network and collaborate with each other. Before I start with the open answer question session, I do want to highlight that we do have the multi-country opportunity available in terms of the South and Central Asia Regional Research Program. So again, this is strictly for research projects that require the scholar to be placed in two or three countries in the region. And if you click on the link, once this webinar is archived, you can click on all of the links that I have here in the webinar, and you can see exactly which countries are participating in the South and Central Asia Regional Research Program. This is also open to all disciplines, and it's for anywhere between 3 to 9 months, and that would be total. So you'd need to do both two or three countries within that time. And you would need, unlike a lot of the other awards in the region, this particular award does require a letter of invitation from all of the hosts that you identify. So if you are looking to do a project in three countries, let's say it's Nepal, Sri Lanka, India, you would need three letters of invitation. Okay, so that is a unique and exciting opportunity in the region. And let me go to the next slide. I'll put this up and let me see. I'm going to open up our question box and see if we've got any questions coming in. So let's see. Research related to, we have a question, how about research related travel within the host country? So I think I just answered that question. And keep in mind, while you're on your grant, should you be selected and you go on your grant, keep in mind that while you're there as a Fulbright scholar, you're only able to take 2 weeks, kind of on, 2 weeks out as a leave period. So the anticipation is that if you're there for 4 months, for example, that you'll be, at the host institution for at least 3.5 of those months. And so, really, the idea is that you would be kind of, the host institution would serve as your home base, and 2 weeks would be given as personal time. Let's see. What else we've got? All right. PhD candidate. Okay, yep. So definitely, if you're a PhD candidate, I would check out the Fulbright student program. If you're interested, are you eligible for a postdoc in Nepal? You're now a U.S. citizen. So I would take a look at the award requirements. I believe we can actually just have a look here. And if we go to the, I've pulled up the list of awards here. And if we go down to Nepal Teaching and Research, if we click on that, we can see if this is open to all career levels. It says open to all levels of scholars except early career. So while we're on this, I'd like to just kind of showcase how you would go about searching for the information that's relevant on the award. So we've got the All Disciplines Award to Nepal. Now here it's a teaching and research grant. What that means is then the grant anticipates that you will propose at least 80%. In this case, it's 80% will be spent on teaching and about 20% on research. So this award is very specific in the ratio of teaching to research. Please note that the other awards in the region that are all disciplines, if they have the teaching and research option, from what I've seen, Kazakhstan requires 50-50 teaching and research, and then the rest of the awards are open. So it's really important for the scholar to determine the ratio of teaching and research. So here we also notice that the grant activity is specified for these four institutions. So the Kathmandu School of Law, the Kathmandu University, and Tribhuvan University, as well as the Pathan Academy of Health Sciences. So here we can see that these are the four locations. They're giving links there as well. In this case, the flex option is not available because the emphasis is on teaching. This is a 5 or 7 month grant, and of course that kind of corresponds to the minimum length of the semester there. And then they'll tell you specifically based on your specialization where you could potentially be affiliated. So this is one thing to take a look at. Let's take a look at the research award and see if that one is open to early career. So this is the All Disciplines Research Award to Nepal, and this one is open to all levels of scholars except early career. So for the applicant who asked about being a postdoc in Nepal, it looks like it is not an option. They do want seasoned scholars, and so you might want to explore other countries within the region. Here we can also see the requirements. A letter of invitation is required. They give the contact of the person at the Fulbright Commission in Kathmandu. They also give a little more information about the profile of the applicant they're looking to host, so an academic or a qualified professional outside of academia. They give the link to the Fulbright Commission in Nepal, and the stipend, the benefits, of course, are all listed here, award benefits. There's approximately one grant. You can see all of the information here on the right side. So that's the case for Nepal. Let's take a look and see, going back to our questions here. What else has come in? For the teaching and research activities in Kazakhstan, who monitors the scholars' activity at the host institution, and who does the scholar report to? Okay, that's a great question. So your host institution will, if you have not identified a collaborator, you will probably be paired with somebody there at the host institution who will be your chief collaborator or the person that you'll be reporting to, so to speak, in the department. And so they'll be kind of your guide and the person that you'd be interacting with kind of as your point of contact. So that would be, unless you have already identified somebody in the department that you would like to do some research with, and then perhaps maybe co-teaching or teach a course in their department. So that's how that would work in terms of being a host. Let's see. Okay. I'm a physician interested in both teaching in India and research. I'm looking at the award. Okay, all right. And what is the question? I suppose the teaching and research. So as long as, just for those of you that are interested in the medical sciences, you're coming from the medical sciences, keep in mind teaching and research is absolutely fine. As long as the research and teaching does not involve any kind of work that requires a license to practice medicine. So the idea is that you wouldn't be touching patients or anything like that. So teaching is fine, and research is fine as long as it doesn't go into that area of dealing with anything that requires a license. Okay, so we see... All right, so I'm interested in a research grant. I teach as an adjunct, but the home institution in the U.S. does not support research. So am I better off applying with an independent scholar or with the school where I adjunct? So it really, I mean, I think, I'm not sure what you mean by your, does that mean if you were to go on a Fulbright grant that you would not be able to, your position would not be guaranteed? If that's the case, I mean, you're applying to the grant. I think it's good to mention that you are teaching at the college as an adjunct. It shows that you do have a home institution, which is nice, and that you could potentially return, and that would kind of speak to the impact. Because really, what the committee is looking for when they review these applications, even if you're an independent scholar, they want to see what are you discussing in terms of the impact not only at the host institution in the host country, but also what is the impact when you come home? You know, not that the Fulbright grant ends when you get on the airplane back to the United States. So we're really looking to see how will, you know, what is the multiplier effect of your award? Will your students benefit? You know, will you bring class, you know, kind of bring your award to life in the classroom? Will you continue collaborations? Perhaps inviting one of the faculty you interacted with in India or wherever you're based to your home institution in the U.S. So we're really looking to see the impact. And if you're an independent scholar, if you only list that, but you're not telling us the full picture about that you do have a home institution potentially, you know, that would kind of not speak to the full impact. So anything that would enhance the impact mentioned in your project statement would be good. Let's see. Housing is often not provided. How much should we plan to spend on housing? Well, there are some countries that assist. I believe they may give some stipends. It really depends on the, let's see, this one it says there's no relocation grant. But if you take a look, the countries, they do, you know, in the orientation they'll tell you and they really try and put you in a situation where you're comfortable, but at the same time, you know, able to have that stipend not just devoted to the housing costs. So all of those, now here, for example, this is the Fulbright Nehru Award to India. There's a living allowance if you have a dependent. There might be a relocation allowance. Let's see, one-time teaching and research allowance. You know, there's different kinds of things here, round-trip airfare. So it's really important to take a look at each of the grants. I've seen letters of invitations from host institutions that even though they didn't have to, they offered the scholar housing on campus or at the institute. So even though that's not required of them and you shouldn't anticipate that, you know, I've seen really kind of enthusiastic letters of invitation where they say, don't worry, you can stay at our guest house, you can stay at the on-campus housing. So see what the host institution can offer if they're interested. Otherwise, they do need to be aware that they don't there's no out-of-pocket expense for the host institution because you are coming under the auspices of the Fulbright program. So make that clear so that they know that, you know, because I've seen also the flip side where institutions were not necessarily familiar with how the Fulbright program worked and they didn't want to issue a letter of invitation because they feared they would have to fund the scholar's visit. So it's important to be clear when you're reaching out to the host institution what exactly the Fulbright program is in case they're unaware. All right, so let's see. More questions coming in. I'm just kind of going through and deleting the ones I've already answered. Okay, got that one. It says Sri Lanka says that the start time will be in October of 2019. This would be in the middle of the semester for them. Would it be possible to go there earlier? So that may just be what the commission in Colombo has requested. So let's take a look at the grant. It says anytime after October 2019. So it looks like they have their reasons, but if you wanted to get more information, I believe they have the commission's contact listed here. And if you're doing some teaching, that would perhaps affect you in the fall term, but if there's a term in the spring or the summer or the winter, however they call it, then you could perhaps do a full semester at the start of 2020. So it's important to kind of sort that out with your host institution. Please note that a letter of invitation is preferred, so you would anyway probably be in contact with the host there and see what works best for both of you in terms of the grant length and the grant activity, because this award is for 3 to 9 months, so there's a lot of scope. All right. So is instruction at all of the at the institutions in English? This is a great question, and yes, for the most part, unless you have local language fluency and, you know, don't mind answering questions in the local language, by all means, in Nepal, in India, in Sri Lanka, in Bhutan, all of the anticipation, in Pakistan, the anticipation is that the course will be taught in English. And in Kazakhstan, for example, they acknowledge that sometimes the students' knowledge in English of technical subjects might not be so good. So there is that kind of mention there that the awards in the sciences may face a little difficulty, but in terms of English. But for the most part, across the Fulbright Scholar Program, the anticipation is that you will teach in English and you would not be required to know the local language. And really that's one thing we try and, you know, really keep the program open to everybody. Now, in terms of research, certainly there's, you know, it depends on what your topic is and what language is required, if at all. If you are doing research where the knowledge of the local language is helpful or required, you certainly should submit the language proficiency. There's a self-evaluation, and then depending on what the award requirements state, whether you need to fill in the, you know, have the external evaluation completed. So here you can see under language requirements, in this case, all teaching will be in English. However, it would be best to discuss the expectations of English language levels with the host. Proficiency in another language is not required. However, now you can see for research applicants, you know, the U.S. Sri Lanka Fulbright Commission looks like they can set you up with a local translator, and so they also, you know, encourage taking one-on-one language lessons. So specifically for research, we understand that knowing some of the language, local language, would help you and you know, kind of ease the process. Okay, so all right, so let's take a look at the other questions coming in. Okay, we have a question about the percentage of applicants actually getting the grant. So please keep in mind that we do not share the application numbers or the selection numbers, and that's part of the Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board policy. So, but in terms of submitting the competitive application, I'll be going through that in the next couple of slides, but we do not share the numbers on that. Yeah, so in terms of the multi-country award, to clarify, that is a regional research grant, so teaching is not a component in that, for that award. All right, let's see what else we have. I'm a doctoral candidate interested in research. I also teach as an adjunct. Okay, so if you're a doctoral candidate, you would need to take a look at the student program, because for the student program, it depends on how far you are in your doctoral program. The student program is open to applicants up until the dissertation. So if you need to do some research for your degree, the Fulbright student program would be a good bet. However, keep in mind, it usually has, you know, a uniform grant length of 9 months for all of the awards, so kind of, you know, the full academic year. If you would like to wait until you've completed your degree, then you'd be more than welcome to apply to the India Award, because you do have the teaching experience and the academic background as a faculty. So it really depends. You're kind of in the gray area, because although the India Award does not require a PhD, if you're pursuing one, you are by default not eligible for the scholar program. All right. Okay, let's see what else has come in. Quite a few questions. Is there a website where I can read the research from past, read the research past Fulbright students have completed in the past? Okay. So for information on the Fulbright student program and some of the grantee experiences, you can certainly check out the Fulbright student, U.S. Fulbright student program website. It's a different website from this one, and that can lead you in the right direction. Okay, we have a question about impact. This is always a big word. In terms of impact, does it make sense to discuss the success of the impact from a previous Fulbright grant that I did in India? It was a student research grant several years ago, okay, but it led to a book, and it did have an impact in my field. Yeah, certainly. I think you can mention that, look, you went there on a grant, you set out to do these different things. Not only did you do that, but it resulted in a book. And it's important to speak. Now, this was a student grant, but even still, you're proposing to go back to India, so you should speak on how you'll continue to build upon your research and why it's important to go back to the country, what you hope to do there, and, of course, the potential impact, the proposed impact when you return to your home institution. So good question there. Can I apply again if I did not get the award, if I applied last year and didn't get the award? Absolutely. So if you applied last year and were not selected for a grant, you're more than welcome to reapply this year. And it's been, you know, we've seen a lot of scholars who have on their second and third attempts have been successful. So, you know, first time round might not have worked out. We certainly welcome you to reapply. Keep in mind one grant, one award per competition. And, you know, while we're on that topic, if for example, there's multiple stages in the review timeline. And let's actually go back. While I take the next questions, I want to kind of continue this, because a lot of the questions will probably center on some of this information. So in terms of the application components, you're well placed right now. It's about mid-June. We have a little over 6.5 weeks, 6 weeks to the deadline, the August 1st deadline. And the application is fairly straightforward. And since most of the awards in the region do not require a letter of invitation, if you're not able to get one by August 1st, not to worry. The award to Bhutan, for example, doesn't even allow you to reach out to the institution, so that one doesn't even require it. In terms of the application, you'll go to the online form, you'll fill all of that out. The project statement is what I'll be discussing in great length. That is where you state in 3 to 5 pages what you hope to do on your grant. We do have page requirements for the rest of the things in terms of the CV and the course syllabi, et cetera. You're required to have 3 letters of reference submitted by August 1st. They will be given, once you log in and create your account online, you add their email addresses, and they'll be receiving an email from our system. So it's important to notify them that you have given their name. And it's always a nice courtesy to let them know that you're applying to the Fulbright, give your referee the draft of your project statement so that they can understand what you hope to do and they can comment on it. And then in terms of the other components for the application, as I mentioned, there are page limits for the course syllabi, the bibliography, and then in terms of the language of proficiency, it may or may not be required depending on what you hope to do. Again, the letter of invitation, it's non-binding. It's something that the host indicates their interest and kind of lets the review committee know that, yes, this person has a potential affiliation and they seem interested and they'll be able to host this scholar. And then if you're from the following backgrounds, art, architecture, writing, and journalism, we do ask for some supplemental materials, kind of in the style of a portfolio, so you can upload different files. And then there is a file, kind of size limit as well. So in terms of the project statement, this is really going to be at the heart of your application, and you should really spend as much time on this, fine-tuning it, and really making sure that not only you have somebody within your discipline proofread it, for the academic merit of it, but also someone outside of your discipline so that they can really, so that it's, accessible to the layperson, to the generalist, because in the peer review process, there will be several layers and people from different faculty and experts from different backgrounds will be looking at this project statement. It's important also to not only identify the specifics in the project and the timeline and all of that, but not to forget about the Fulbright program and why you're applying to the Fulbright. We understand there are several grant agencies out there and different funding sources available, but you're interested in the Fulbright grant. So why is that? Why? What is it about the Fulbright mission, cultural diplomacy, mutual understanding, kind of the people-to-people collaborative approach? Tell us how that all fits in your project, why it's important to you. And be as specific as possible in terms of the specific courses you plan to teach if you're doing teaching or the methods and the goals of your research. And again, the outcomes and the impact. Really, we want to see that mentioned as well. And then last but not least, how adaptable are you? So the South and Central Asia region is a very dynamic, it's a very diverse region. It's a vast region, and India being the second largest in terms of the population, the largest democracy in the world, so to speak. So all of these different things, the diversity there, the different levels of development. If you have a plan, for example, where you're teaching a course that relies a lot on using the internet, and you get to your host institution and perhaps the internet connection is not as strong or maybe there's some outages, how adaptable can you be in converting that to a positive situation where the students are still engaged and you're able to teach the course smoothly and deliver? So the idea is that, plan A might not always work out. Do you have a plan B? I've heard stories of grantees develop an entire curriculum for the teaching that they were going to do, and when they got to their host institution, they realized that the level was very different than what they anticipated of the students, and so they had to recalibrate. So are you able to do that and kind of take things in stride? Going to the affiliations, the letter of invitation. So in the case of the award to Nepal, for example, we saw that there were four hosts outlined and identified. They were listed there. But the vast majority of the awards in the region do not have any hosts that are preferred or listed in the award. So if the host is not identified, you can start by taking a look and seeing if you're at a campus, if there's any connections you have in terms of has a scholar come from that country or have any Fulbrighters from your campus gone to those countries and what affiliations they had. You can also take a look at our scholar directory. And that you can search according to discipline, according to country. So you could search Sri Lanka and law, for example, and see all of the grantees from the U.S. who have gone to Sri Lanka whose discipline was law. And then you can see where they've been affiliated. And then you can also, of course, if the host commission, the binational commission website is listed or the contact or any resources are there, you can start there on the award requirements. Now, keep in mind the letter of invitation is non-binding. There might be several applicants reaching out to the same host institution. So keep in mind it doesn't mean that it's 100% certain, but certainly the commission takes a look at this, or the embassy in the case of the countries that don't have a commission, the U.S. embassy facilitates the program and coordinates everything there. So they may see that and they confirm that. So keep that in mind. Now, in terms of who it should come from and who is it addressed to, the person that you'll be collaborating with the closest should be the one writing the letter of invitation, and that should be addressed to you. and it should be on the institutional letterhead. Now, if the particular host institution has a requirement that other higher level people need to sign off on it, like the vice chancellor or the provost, that's fine, but it should be clearly mentioned who you'll be collaborating with on a day-to-day basis. And in terms of the points, the kind of tips that we have for you in submitting a competitive application, again, you might want to just take a look at this. As I mentioned, it's important to address the Fulbright goal of, you know, people-to-people diplomacy, and why in particular this country that you're applying to. Is there a need for an in-country grant? In other words, if you're just dealing with, for example, if you're just dealing with data sets, you're not indicating what the need is to be in that country. You could do this. Maybe the review committee would say, well, this person can run this data at home. They don't need, you know, they don't need a Fulbright to India or to Uzbekistan. So really demonstrating the need for being in the country, and then, of course, the outcomes, the multiplier effect, any future collaborations, et cetera. So while we're here, let's take a look at the questions that have come in. All right, so let's see. Okay, so we had a question about what makes an application stand out, what are the most important qualities of a successful application. So I hope this slide kind of helps you in determining really, you know, some of the things that the review committee is going to be looking at. And it's important to take a look at the review criteria that we have on our website, and I'll jump to that after we complete the slides. And there's kind of a checklist that we provide for you to go through and make sure that you've outlined everything that you need to outline in your project statement. Again, it's only 3 to 5 pages, so we don't require you to give any citations or anything like that or references, because we realize those 3 to 5 pages are precious space for you to clearly demonstrate what the project is, why, you know, the importance of the project, why that particular country, why that particular host institution, how you are the best fit to do this based on your profile and your expertise, et cetera, and all of those things, you know, the outcomes, your potential as a cultural ambassador, you know, you are going over as an American scholar, a scholar of the United States, and so we want you to be able to kind of speak to that as well. All right, so what else have we got? Okay, so let's see. Can you please cover information on the independent project track? Okay, so independent, I'm not quite clear what the project track is. We do have a couple of awards that are project awards. So there's an award to Finland for mid-career professionals where you're not required to teach or research. It's just kind of an award that contributes to your professional development. And there's another award where the host countries are either Peru, Côte d'Ivoire, Ukraine, or I'm trying to remember the last one, but none of them are in the South and Central Asia region, and that is, again, for mid-career, early career applicants in public policy. So I'm not aware. Perhaps you can email me in the South and Central Asia inbox, and we can kind of discuss that one-on-one. All right. So more questions coming in. So, yeah, so we have a good question. Should I provide technical details in the research proposal, and how much technical verbiage is okay in the project statement, so kind of the jargon. So, again, keep in mind that this is read not only, you know, your application is reviewed not only by peers in your discipline, but peers outside of your discipline. So faculty from a range of, disciplines are going to be looking at this as well. Plus, if you're recommended at the peer review level and your application is forwarded to the in-country commission or the post, which is the embassy, that they may or may not be from your background. So you need to be able to communicate it in such a way that the layperson can also understand the value and the importance of your project, the need for your project, and how it relates to the particular country and host. So if you get too technical, you'll have the readers lost. And if you're not technical enough, then we may or may not know if, you know all of the discipline reviewers may question things as well. So it's important to strike a fine balance between speaking only to the specialist and speaking to the generalist. So I hope that answers your question there. Okay, so we have a question. If I'm interested in teaching, how do I identify what the host institution needs in terms of the course so that I can shape the course materials to benefit the host? Okay, that's a good question. So for all of the awards, with the exception of Bhutan, we encourage the applicants to, I believe Bhutan and perhaps Turkmenistan as well, you're more than welcome to identify a host institution and communicate with them, write them an email, propose what you'd like to do, kind of gauge their interest, and if they're interested in having you there, then you can determine what exactly you would be doing in terms of teaching. Now, some awards do state you need to teach two classes at the undergrad or graduate level. I'm not aware of that for the case in the awards in South and Central Asia, but I know several awards in other countries are very strict with, they outline how many hours a week you'll be teaching and for how many weeks. So it's important to take a look at the award, see what's required for teaching, and then inform the host institution of your plan and see what works for them. They might, say, yes, we'd love to have you teach XYZ. Can you do this? And so you really have to kind of communicate and go back and forth with them to understand their needs. Okay, so can you apply to two countries at the same time, for example, India and Nepal? So the answer is yes. We do have that multi-country award option, which is the South and Central Asia Regional Research Program Award. But if you mean in terms of can I apply to two different awards, the answer is no. So you can only apply to one award per competition, but we do have the South and Central Asia Regional Research Program, which allows you to select up to between two and three countries for your research project. So there is a way around that. Are there any special pieces of information about the Fulbright Flex in India? And yes, we can actually go back to the catalog, and I'd like to point out the Flex Award is specifically for research grants, and they do have different parameters in terms of grant length and how the grant will be carried out, grant activity will be carried out. So here you can see, now this is the Academic and Professional Excellence Award to India. It's a 4 to 9 month grant, you'll see here, but for Flex, the grant length is 4 to 6 months. So there, that's the first difference. The second difference is that the minimum length of any grant segment is 1 month and the maximum is 5. So the anticipation is that you will be undertaking two grant segments over 1 or 2 consecutive academic years. So if you need another or other, if you need 3 visits or 4 visits, if you need to break that up, the flight cost then, from my understanding, would come out of your pocket. But the funding is available for 2 round-trip tickets so that you would be able to go back and forth for 2 segments. So you could potentially do 2 months and 2 months or 1 and 3 or, 1 and 5. So the idea is that there are some parameters for the flex option. And you should also address this in your project statement. We need to see a timeline of how you'll, how and when you'll be doing this project. So as much detail as possible, as well as the justification, why are you selecting the flex? So keep in mind, the award to India offers 45 grants, and you'll see 15 of those are earmarked for flex. So they need to see, the committee and the commission abroad, they need to see the need, either it, you're doing a longitudinal study or whatever the case is where your research requires it, or you're unable to leave your home institution for the full 6 months of the grant. So this is the only way for you to do this, feasibly, breaking it up into 2 segments. So those are the things we do need to see that you state the need of the flex. All right, so let us, and if you'd want to, let's see, successful Fulbright grants. So you can take a look at the Fulbright Commission in India's webpage to see. I think they might indicate who has been on a flex before. In our scholar directory, if you go to our homepage and you go to the scholar directory, unfortunately, we don't have the search option for flex. But what you can do is you can type in India, and you can, let's say we're looking, you know, if you know, if you are looking for a particular discipline. But here what we can do is we can pull up all of the grantees since 2011. Again, keep in mind this is only in the past 8 years, who have gone to India and where they've been affiliated. So when you click on a name here, you can see the title of their project. So if that'll help, feel free to kind of scour our Fulbright Scholar directory for more information. All right. So let's see. All right, let's take a look at some other questions coming in. Okay, so in terms of letters of recommendation, I'm not currently affiliated with the university. I've only taught one class at the graduate level. Since I only taught that class, do I still need the departmental chair to complete a letter of recommendation, or could I have someone else who knows my teaching and workshop facilitation better in the context of teaching with? That's a good question because it seems like both of them have about the same level of exposure to your teaching. I think whoever could speak who has more in-depth knowledge of your teaching, but keep in mind the review committee might be looking for the departmental chair's recommendation because ideally, that is the one formal teaching experience you had, and so that would be anticipated. And I believe, we also list that in our website that ideally for the teaching grants, it should be from the departmental chair. And if you're not currently associated or affiliated with a home institution, it would be from the previous institution where you taught. However, if this other person who knows your teaching style very well, I don't think it hurts to have both of them, and then the third one can be speaking to your research. Because if you're doing teaching, keep in mind, the review committee really wants to ensure that you're the right person to be teaching this class, you're the right person to be in the classroom with these students, and so it wouldn't hurt to have both of them. And then the third one, of course, would speak to your research. So I think that's a safe way of approaching that since you've only got one formalized kind of class on your resume. All right, so let's take a look. Oops, my mouse is having a little bit of an issue. Here we go. All right, moving on to the next question. Are we allowed to only submit one proposal per year? Yes, so you need to select one award to apply to, and if you're not selected, then you're more than welcome to reapply in the following year, but only one application, one award per applicant. All right, so we have a question, and I think this is a great question. It says, after passing the first round of reviews, I was not selected. Can you explain the reasons and how I can improve my chances? So yes, absolutely. And in fact, now that we're on a question like that, let's go back to our PowerPoint and let's take a look at the review process and timeline. So this person was not successful after the first round. So keep in mind the August 1st deadline, right after that, the entire month of August is devoted to the technical review of the applications for eligibility and completeness. Then the first round of peer reviews takes place in September, and that is the discipline-specific committees that are reviewing applications for that specific discipline. From September to early November, we then convene the peer review committees in Washington, D.C., and these are peer reviewers that have been, they are alumni of the program, they've been to that region or that particular country, and they come from a wide variety of disciplines, and they are there to ultimately recommend or not recommend applications for final review in country, so either at the Fulbright Commission or in the case of smaller countries, there is the U.S. Embassy Public Affairs Section that takes care of the Fulbright program. So from my understanding, it looks like the person who wrote the question, they may not have passed the peer review. So in that case, what I would recommend is taking a look at our, going back to our website and looking at the peer review, the review criteria, and when you go here, you can see really what the reviewers are looking at when they are reviewing and kind of assessing your application. So there's different parameters for teaching and research, and if you're doing teaching and research, you need to make sure that you fulfill both of these requirements. And of course, in general, that you are, you know, that you have the credentials and the experience and the profile, the record of service, either in teaching or research, to be a Fulbrighter. So we're looking for competitive applications that are compelling, not only to the host, but in general to the program that fulfill really the mission as well. So I suggest going through all of this and making sure that you really put your best foot forward and that you address all of the things, you know, any kind of long-term experience abroad, any personal qualities and things that would, you know, examples that would indicate you would be a good Fulbrighter abroad, as well as addressing any previous Fulbright grants, taking a look also at our application guidelines and kind of the checklists that we provide, ensuring that everything was really at the best level that you could have submitted it. So again, one of the advice, you know, the key pieces of advice that we give our applicants is having the statement, your project statement read not only by peers in your discipline, but also outside of your discipline. Making sure, taking a look at the letter of invitation that you had, if you had a letter of invitation, taking a look at it, was the tone enthusiastic or did it sound perfunctory? Was it the bare minimums or really did it have all of the specifics? Anything that could really enhance your project and your application, you might want to just go through and see what could have been better. Okay, so let's see. Okay, for the degree requirement, some awards list PhD or terminal degree. Does that also include DBA? So is this Doctor of Business Administration? If that is, then that would be a doctorate degree. So what terminal degree, for example, a terminal degree may not have, may not be a PhD or an EdD or a DBA or a JD. It might be an MFA because that is considered a terminal degree in the fine arts. So just checking with us, reaching out to us, you can check, for example, in architecture, a master's degree is considered a terminal degree. In social work, it differs. For the practitioner, an MSW is considered a terminal degree. For those that are in teaching and research, a DSW is considered a terminal degree. So it really depends on your discipline. Okay, all right, great. So we have a question about doing a comparative research project in India and Germany. So again, this would be something for the global program that I mentioned earlier. So if you take a look here and we go to search all awards, let's actually go to the multi-country and we can click on, we need to go to region. And here you'll be able to click on global and you'll be able to see exactly not only the multi-country regional grants, but information about the global Scholar Award. So since Germany is in Europe and India is in South Asia, this would qualify because two of the countries need to be in two different world regions. So you could check this out and see what the award parameters are for the Global Scholar Award. So we have reached the 3 o'clock hour. Time flies, and I have not been able to get to all of your questions. What I can do is I will follow up with the few remaining questions that we have. And again, I'd like to thank you for attending this webinar and for beginning your application. Those of you that joined in today are right on track. You have about 6 weeks until the end of the award competition. So I'm here to help you and answer your questions by email, by phone. You can set up a phone consultation with me. I'm happy to also review your letters of invitation, to review any of your project statements if you're not sure if you're on the right path. Keep in mind it is a busy time for all of us here in the Fulbright Scholar Program, but we do welcome your emails and look forward to collaborating with you so that you can submit a competitive application. So on that note, I will end the webinar. And again, thank you once again for joining us today and wish you all the best in submitting your application.